From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Treasury Department recently imposed sanctions on Russian government officials, businessmen, and corporations over accusations that are referred to as, quote, worldwide malign activity. According to the Treasury Department, the sanctions were meant to ensure that, quote, Russian oligarchs and elites who profit from this corrupt system will no longer be insulated from the consequences of their government's destabilizing activities. While the U.S. is engaged in what many fear may be a revival of the Cold War, one journalist has pointed out in a new book that there are thousands of Americans who have chosen to live in Russia. Through the experiences and motivations of these Americans, author Dina Stryker explores the contemporary landscape of U.S.-Russia relations. Dina Stryker is a photojournalist. Her earlier book is Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution, as well as Inside the Cuban Revolution with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez, and a number of other books, including Lunch with Fellini, Dinner with Fidel, A Journey from the Cold War to the Arab Spring. She joins me to discuss her latest book, Russia's Americans. Welcome to the program, Dina.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks for joining us. So you've moved your focus from Cuba to Russia. And tell me a little bit about how you put the book together. You traveled to Russia and you met with Americans who are living in Russia, having families in Russia, and basically living out their lives in Russia. What motivated you to go and explore this sort of subgroup of Americans who live in Russia?
Well, it's when I at first was put in touch with a really remarkable woman named Sharon Tennyson, a nurse from California who has been taking Americans to Russia since the late 1980s. And I was put in touch with her by another journalist, you know how it goes. And I was so taken with the book that she wrote about her experiences taking Americans to meet their counterparts in Russia, that I thought it would be worthwhile exploring the whole matter further, especially when I discovered, according to the Moscow Times, the daily paper in English in Moscow, that there are literally thousands of Americans living all across Russia, not only in Moscow.
So we here in the United States are hearing a lot about Russia in our headlines, something that happened routinely in the United States decades ago in the height of the Cold War. But as was the case in the past, today we just seem to have information coming to us through a lens, through a filter. We don't know enough about life in Russia for ordinary Russians. And these Americans that choose to live in Russia may be able to give us a more accurate glimpse. Tell us a little bit about some of the people you met and what motivates and what might be motivating an American to live in Russia. Presumably it involves work and opportunity.
Right, right. Well, you know, if I may go back to the period when I was visiting Cuba in the early years of the revolution, the problem has not changed in terms of the kinds of information that Americans receive about the outside world from the media. And so they hear only one side of an issue, the side that their government at any given moment wants them to hear. And it's very distorted. When I went to Cuba, it was precisely because I'd heard from people who had been there that things were not the way they were being described by the Western press. And the same is true for Russia, especially these days, when there seems to be a plan, if I may say, to ultimately challenge Russia on the battlefield, however crazy that may be. It seems that it's the basic thrust of the national security doctrine that has been in effect since the mid-1990s after the Soviet Union broke up. So we get very one-sided information, and we are being prepared to go to war.
So tell me about these Americans in Russia and what motivates them. Can you give us some names and some details?
Well, the people that I met were mostly young people who had either studied political science in college or they had studied Russian, the Russian language, then they would go over for a semester and they would discover that, hey, it isn't the way we're being told. It's a whole different ball game. It's a whole different place. And some of them chose to go back to Russia when they graduated, and they can easily get work because there is a great demand for people to teach English. There are many, many, many private schools offering English classes to Russians, and they're eager for to get teachers, and the government makes it very easy for people who can teach English to get a work permit and get settled and get a place to live and all that. So,
So ironically, America is exporting Americans to Russia because there are some job opportunities there that they might not feel they have here.
well, I don't think it's because they wouldn't have work here, but if they're interested in Russia or the Russian language and they get to see that it's a different place from what they're being told, and they're young and they have basically nothing to lose, and they have their whole life in front of them. Why not? There are some older people, of course, living there who have been there because their company sent them there 20 or 30 years ago, and they married a Russian and stayed there, or any number of possibilities, different types of people. Some of the people that I interviewed, I had to do so by email, because they were living far, far away from Moscow.
Right. It's a
Again,
big country.
yes, it's the biggest country in the world. It has 11 time zones, and
Wow.
that's a lot of space to cover. But
Now, yeah.
even people living in what we would call the boonies are happy because they have they appreciate a slower lifestyle, a more family-oriented kind of community that apparently is prevalent in Russia as opposed to here.
What from being in Russia, from meeting these people, what can you tell us, or can you put into perspective this narrative that has now emerged in the US polity that Russia is interested in politically destabilizing the US, that it has these hordes of underground hackers ready to overturn our elections and push them in a way that's favorable to Russian interests, that they use social media, and they use their propaganda arm through their English language television station RT. What can you tell us about this narrative that we aren't really getting?
Well, the narrative is pretty straightforward. When the Soviet Union broke apart, Gorbachev was in contact with the Bush administration, and he was assured if the Soviet Union gave permission for Germany to be reunited, then NATO would not move one inch beyond the eastern border of Germany. That was how Germany was reunited at the end of the Cold War. And then the other countries of Eastern Europe became gradually part of the European Union. But lo and behold, with membership in the European Union came practically automatic membership in NATO. And NATO has been moving its troops and its tanks and its all kinds of weapons steadily eastward toward Russia, to the extent that today NATO is camped all along Russia's western border. And that means that the traditional route by which Russia has been invaded from the west, that is the Eastern European route, is now in part of NATO, and we have hold exercises, military exercises, and war games, and all sorts of things. In fact, in a recent interview that I caught, thanks to the website Russia Insider, Putin remarked that he does have a sense of humor. He remarked that maybe the United States thought it was bringing democracy to Russia by way of NATO.
So clearly, the US and Western Europe has very aggressively attempted to corner Russia since the end of the Cold War. However, they would contend that it's Russia that has been trying to expand with its adventures in Ukraine across the board, its annexation of Crimea. How is that viewed from a Russian perspective?
Well, as for Ukraine, I think there's so much evidence online in videos at YouTube, everywhere you go. You don't have to wonder how it happened that Ukraine, the elected president who was pro-Russian, Yanukovych, was forced to flee in February of 2014 because, as Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for East European and Russian Affairs at the Clinton at the State Department, at the Obama State Department, bragged to the press in the end of 2013 that the US had spent $5 billion assisting revolutionary developments in Ukraine. And this, of course, came to a head in the early part of 2014 in February, when it was presented to the West as being a spontaneous revolution, but of course it wasn't really spontaneous. In fact, aside from the good people of good faith who thought they were making a revolution and who wanted change, there were militias that had been training for years for just such a chance to show their muscle. These militias who worship a World War II hero named Stepan Bandera, who tried to obtain Ukraine independence by collaborating with Hitler's regime. They didn't get their independence. Hitler used them and then threw them away when he couldn't use them anymore. But this person, Stepan Bandera, is a hero to a whole section of nationalist Ukrainians. And you can see online, if you Google Ukrainian militias, that they wear Nazi insignia or variations on Nazi insignia, the whole nine yards. And they are now part of the government. In fact, that one of the leaders of these militias was for a time the head of the Ministry of the Interior of Ukraine. So it's extremely worrisome, but not for the reasons that we are being told. As for the so-called invasion by Russia, you know, people who have a little notion of geography, one look at the map tells you that if Russia had really invaded Ukraine, they would have been in Kiev at the opposite end of the country within a day or two. And what has happened is that Russian volunteers have been helping the people in the eastern provinces of Ukraine that border on Russia, who are mainly Russian speaking, who don't want to live under a fascist regime and decided that they had to be independent. Those are the Russians that are. They're being helped by Russians from Russia, but there has never been an invasion of any way, shape, or form of Ukraine by Russia. And as far as Crimea is concerned, Crimea has been Russian since the time of Catherine the Great, when she got it away from the Turks, and she built a big naval base there. And what happened was it was always Russian up until 1954, when Khrushchev, for some reason that we don't really know, but we think it was sort of emotional ties to Ukraine, he gifted Crimea to Ukraine. And after the events of February 2014, the people in Crimea, who are mainly Russian speakers, there is a Tatar minority, but most of the people in Crimea are Russians. They wanted to go back to Russia. They've always apparently wanted to go back to Russia. So Russia helped them organize a referendum, which was similar to the referendum that took place in Kosovo in the 1990s, which America totally approved of and backed and helped, etc. And they voted, you know, some 90% of Crimeans voted to return to Russia. So that's how that happened.
So, but we're
story.
Why do you think, what does the U.S. and what do the U.S. and Western Europe get out of instilling a fear of Russia? Is it that it gives NATO a reason to continue to exist?
I don't think that's the main reason, although, of course, it does do that. It gives NATO a reason to exist. But you have to know that Russia has a cornucopia of very precious minerals and metals and all sorts of good things, rich black soil, you name it, they've got it. And they've got it in spades. And it is something that, it is a wealth that potentially can empower Russia to be more powerful than the United States, which is what is stated in the Wolfowitz Doctrine that I referred to earlier, that was drafted in 1995 or around that time by Paul Wolfowitz. And they refer to the fact that the main doctrine is no country should be allowed to challenge the hegemony, the world hegemony of the United States. And it outlines all kinds of things that the United States has to do to prevent this from happening. And it mentions the fact that Russia could eventually pretend to challenge the United States, in part thanks to this mineral wealth that it has. So basically, the United States has been trying to provoke Russia into doing things that would then serve as an excuse for attacking it.
Well, Dina, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My guest is Dina Stryker, photojournalist and author of Cuba, Diary of the Cuban Revolution, and a number of other books about Cuba. We've been discussing her latest book, Russia's Americans. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.